Last time we spoke about Operation Hago, Yugo, and some action brewing up on New Britain and Bungayville. General Mutaguchi basically tricked his superiors at Tokyo into allowing him to attempt a full invasion of India. Operations Hago and Yugo were simultaneously unleashed. The only problem was, the Allies were ready to meet them. General Slim's men captured documents indicating the true nature of the operations, and he acted accordingly. The new box defense systems were employed as the Allies lured the Japanese into major traps, thwarting their designs against Imphal. The Japanese were fighting tenaciously, but time and supplies would not be on their side. Over on New Britain, the Allies advanced and managed to seize Talisay. Meanwhile, in Bougainville, the Japanese were preparing a large counteroffensive, attempting to breach the American defensive perimeter. The operation had just kicked off last episode, and today we will continue the story. This episode is the Bougainville Counteroffensive. Welcome back to the Pacific War Podcast week by week, and I'm your dutiful host, Greg Watson. But before we begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II, and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. Hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, the Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I have just released my full documentary on the Battle of Attu, Bloods, Blizzards, and Banzai. For that episode, I put a hell of a lot of work into it to try and give it more of a brutality and feeling to it. Also, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where over there you can find exclusive Patreon podcasts. Recently, I have released a two-part series on the full history of the USS Enterprise. And again, a big thanks to everybody who's already joined up. You guys are awesome. The Marines were departing Bougainville and being relieved by the AmeriCorps Division by the end of January 1944. Sporadic fighting emerged, and through it, Major General Griswold obtained intelligence indicating the Japanese would launch a major counterattack, most likely slated for early March. At the time, Lieutenant General Hayakatake was under extreme pressure to reduce the bombing against Rabaul. Rabaul was being smashed daily, suffering heavy losses. Admiral Koga had responded by taking away air units from Truk, but all this achieved was even more losses. Rabaul was neutralized, and Truk became more vulnerable. The Americans had pummeled both so much, they were able to unleash a dramatic thrust into the Central Pacific aimed at the Gilberts, the Marshalls, and later on the Carolines. Now it seems General Hayakatake had been operating under some very bad intelligence, indicating to him the Americans were defending their perimeter with just a single division around the airfield. With the objective of destroying that said airfield, Hayakatake did not know the actual number of defenders, and he would not enjoy movement by sea. The Americans had full control over the sea lanes, thus any IGN destroyers trying to move troops would run a risky gauntlet. By the first quarter of 1944, Rabaul had tossed meager attacks against the Americans. For example, on January the 23rd, two bombers scored a direct hit over the living quarters of Brigadier General John Hodge and his senior staff officers. Now, what General Hayakatake had to work with was 4,300 men of the 45th Regiment, led by Colonel Isashi Magata. These men were considered the crack troops on Bougainville, and they included artillery, motor, and engineering battalions. They were further supported by 4,125 men of the 23rd Regiment, led by Major General Shuniwara, and 1,350 men of the 13th Regiment, led by Colonel Toyo Horimuda. All three of these units combined would be led by Major General Masatane Kanda. The three units made an arduous trek through the jungles to reach their jump-off points by the evening of March the 7th. Hayakatake then sent them a resounding message.
"The time has come to manifest our knighthood with the pure brilliance of the sword.
It is our duty to erase the mortification of our brothers at Guadalcanal. Attack. Assault. Destroy everything. Cut. Slash. And mow them down. May the color of the red emblem on our arms be deepened with the blood of American rascals. Major General Kanda also added his own message. The cry of our victory at Torokina Bay shall resound to the shores of our beloved Nippon. We are invincible. All these troops received a large morale boost from such messages. But on top of that, there was something else incentivizing them all. They had adequate food to last them until April the 1st. They literally needed to overrun the Americans to steal their provisions. Such was the reality of the Japanese island-hopping campaigns. Haikutake's forces proved themselves far from invincible. Their artillery began to bombard on the morning of the 8th, targeting the airfield at Pivayok. Their bombardment destroyed a bomber, three fighters, killed a single man, and forced a temporary evacuation of aircraft to New Georgia. It was not exactly the greatest of results. Artilleryman Stan Coleman vividly described the Japanese artillery strike as, "All of a sudden, we heard a very different kind of whoosh. It was made by a shell at the end of its flight, not the beginning. It was incoming mail. All hell broke loose. In the rear, some fuel dumps went up. Every American artillery piece in the perimeter went into action." The American artillery counterattack proved far more effective. The Japanese artillery units were forced to move positions constantly, and then they were met by a new type of weapon. As Coleman recalled, "Four Blue Marine Corsairs came in with rockets. Rockets were a new ground support weapon, and I had never seen them. The rockets in flight made a fearful display. There was a tremendous concuss when they struck their target." That same night, the Iwasa unit attacked Hill 700 during a heavy downpour. Yet by 2:30 a.m., the first attacks were beaten off. It seems the experience persuaded the Japanese not to attempt another night attack on March the 9th. Instead, they used the occasional machine gun and mortar fire to disrupt the fitful sleep of the Americans. Then at 6:45 a.m. on the 10th, Iwasa launched another attack in coordination with Colonel Muda's assault against Hill 260. Iwasa's men clambered up steep 70-degree slopes, screaming maniacally. They would shout confused threats in English. A prolific slaughter occurred against one group of Japanese soldiers who seized a pillbox and set up a machine gun post on the saddle of the hill. It was dearly bought. General Griswold had brought up more reinforcements for the 145th that same morning. Engineers had put together a Bangalore torpedo 72 feet long by connecting sticks of dynamite with a long pipe. The object was to climb the hill and then snake the charge down to the opposite side into one of the pillboxes. Unfortunately, the Japanese spotted them and fired a new mortar, hitting the torpedo and killing the engineers. Another ruse was attempted shortly after noon with the object of getting the Japanese on the saddle to surrender. A public address system was set up with speakers aimed at Hill 700, and one of the division's Japanese interpreters spoke to the defenders. He informed them of the odds against their success and told them that they could not be reinforced. But if they surrendered, it would be considered honorable. To die needlessly was foolish. For the short time he spoke, all was quiet, but seconds after he had finished, the Japanese directed a mortar barrage on the section of the hill from whence he was broadcasting. The day ended in victory for the riflemen of the 37th Division. At 11:15, an airstrike by 26 planes and continuous artillery fire had devastated the Japanese. The day's assault cost the lives of some 500 or more Japanese soldiers. Meanwhile, further south, the 1st Battalion, 13th Regiment, was knocked out by heavy artillery fire. Colonel Muda had sent his 3rd Battalion, 13th Regiment, to attack the southern positions of the 182nd Regiment around Hill 260. Hill 260 was a twin-peaked rise close to the west bank of the Torokina River, approximately 4 miles north of its mouth. It was covered with heavy vegetation. The hill itself measured only 850 yards along its north-south axis, and its widest a mere 450 yards. It was shaped roughly like an hourglass, with the highest elevations to the north and south, connected by a narrow saddle. The eastern slope of the hill was precipitous, steepest along the south knob, where it was almost perpendicular. The South Knob, which was considered the most important part of Hill 260, had been occupied by men of the 2nd Battalion, 182nd Regiment, since early January, and a vigorous patrolling had also been carried out regularly along the Saddle and on the unoccupied North Knob. The hill was about half a mile east of the 182nd's main line of resistance. Between Hill 260 and the main line of defense for the Americal Division was a small stream named Eagle Creek, which provided a natural defensive barrier. There was but a single trail leading from the main perimeter to the South Knob. A small bridge over the creek could take vehicle traffic. The last 100 yards to the top of the South Knob was a steep stairway cut into the sides of the hill. Possession of this portion of the hill was important for both sides. The Americans had built a platform near the top of the 150-foot Bayan Tree from which forward observers could see enemy activity along the Torokina River or along the highlands to the northeast. Conversely, if the Japanese could seize the hill, they could have a good observation of the American-held hills 608 and 309 in the area just behind them. Under the cover of intense machine gun and mortar fire, the Japanese managed to climb the steep slope of the South Knob, and then they burst in among the outnumbered Americans. The position was held by a reinforced platoon of Company G of the 182nd and a forward observer team of the 246th Field Artillery Battalion. The Americans were rapidly wiped out and dispersed as Muda's men established a defensive perimeter over the crest of South Knob. Hearing of the dire news, General Griswold ordered General Hodge to hold Hill 260 at all costs, an order that surprised many of the American staff since they had not expected to try and hold the hill in the face of such a concentrated Japanese attack. Companies E and F immediately advanced to occupy the North Knob, and then they attempted an encircling maneuver to counterattack the newly established Japanese perimeter. Company E at 8:45 attacked the South Knob from the southwest while Company F moved south. The company began its attack at 10:45, but halted after the troops had advanced just a few yards into the cleared zone. The men took whatever cover was available and they waited for flamethrower units before trying to advance any further. At approximately 2:45 p.m., the commander, Lieutenant Colonel Dexter Lowry, ordered the attack to be resumed. Company E split and attempted an envelopment maneuver. The northern prong of the envelopment was halted, but the infantrymen of the southern prong, using grenades and flamethrowers, managed to gain a lodgment within an earshot of the men of Company G, who were still holding out in a pillbox. Meanwhile, the 1st and 2nd Battalions of the 145th Regiment had been reorganized and launched a counterattack against Hill 700 at 5. The Japanese unleashed intense mortar and artillery attacks, but gradually they were dislodged from the crest of the hill, leaving just four pillboxes remaining under their control. After the reestablishment of the original resistance line, Iwasa prepared his men to storm Pat's Nose during the night. The Japanese had lost heavily during these attacks, which had cost the 145th 3 dead and 121 wounded. During the night after a failed bayonet charge, the Japanese would reinforce their position on Hill 260. They then struck at Company E early in the morning of March the 11th, and although this attack had been beaten off, the American situation in the lodgment had become quite desperate. Thus, after another Japanese flanking attack, the defenders would have to pull back towards North Knob. Company G was sent to relieve the beleaguered Company E, but they were halted by yet another Japanese flanking attack on Company E. General Hodge, fearful of reducing his main defensive line, felt that he could send no more reserves to the hill, and therefore decided to break off the action and pull Company G and what was left of Company E off the southern knob. They retired unimpeded by the Japanese behind Eagles Creek. There they joined up with Company B, and then they would proceed to cut a new trail up the crest to North Knob. At daybreak on March the 11th, Iwasa launched another attack against the promontory called Pat's Nose, some 150 yards to the west of Hill 700. Flanking 37mm guns cut the Japanese charge to shreds. Iwasa's rear echelons kept advancing over the dead bodies of those who had been leading the charge, and eventually managed to break through the barbed wire, though they were ultimately destroyed. After an hour of suicidal attack, Iwasa's troops receded, leaving some 84 dead behind them. The 37th Division's historian described the attack as such. Brandishing their prized sabers, screaming, "Jusuto! Damn them!" The Japanese officers climbed up the slope and rushed forward in an admirable display of blind courage. The men screamed in reply, "Yarazo! Let's do it!" And then, "Yarimozo! We will do it." As they closed with the American doughboys, the leaders cried, "Sanenkire! Cut 1,000 men. General Beitler, concerned over the inability of the 145th to reduce the Japanese positions on Hill 700, decided to send the 2nd Battalion, 148th Regiment, to finally wipe out the enemy opposition. After a heavy mortar and artillery bombardment, two platoons of Company E advanced east from Pat's Nose, trying to flank the saddle, while a third attacked west from Hill 700. 13 men were killed before the momentum of the attack waned and the battalion dug in on the ground it had gained. Meanwhile, Companies F and B, now under the command of Brigadier General William McCulloch, began a two-pronged attempt to drive the Japanese off the southern knob. Supported by flamethrower units from the 132nd, men of Company B got across the saddle and onto the knob, but they were ultimately pulled because of the enemy's numerical superiority. Meanwhile, Colonel Magata's 45th Regiment had limited its actions to heavy patrol activity, while the Iwasa unit was attacking Hill 700. The terrain fronting the 129th Regiment, which was holding the center of the 37th Divisional Line, was much more favorable for the Japanese than that encountered by either Iwasa or Muda's forces. The land was relatively flat, although cut by many gullies. The 129th Line, defended by two battalions, extended over 2 miles, curving slightly from just east of the Numa-Numa Trail, southwest to the right flank of the 148th Regiment. The Japanese had easy access to the 37th lines, first via the Numa-Numa Trail, and then following the lowlands and gullies adjacent to the creeks. Colonel John Frederick, the regimental commander of the 129th, had recognized the potential vulnerability of this position, and he had organized a defense in depth during the 2 months prior to the attack. The position was anchored by a large number of mutually supporting earthen and log pillboxes and protected by double aprons of barbed wire, in front of which anti-personnel mines had been laid. Machine guns had been sighted to provide interlocking fire, and additional barbed wire had been placed to channel potential attackers into the main machine gun fire lanes. The 129th Cannon Company, with their 75mm pack howitzers and their mortar sections, had been augmented by 37mm and 40mm anti-tank guns, which could fire canisters in flat trajectory direct fire. Thus, although Colonel Magata's men did not have to climb up steep cliffs to get at the American positions, they would find the 129th's defenses near impregnable to relatively lightly supported infantry attacks, no matter how fanatically delivered. While patrolling, some documents were taken from some dead Japanese bodies detailing Magata's plan, so Colonel John Frederick's 129th Regiment were expecting this thrust. On the 11th, the contact between the Japanese and American patrols increased, as did the amount of incoming mortar fire, so the American supporting artillery was directed to fire intermittently into areas where the Japanese were located. Colonel Frederick at 4 p.m. ordered all of his outposts back into the main perimeter, and the divisional artillery fired a 10-minute concentration along the 2nd Battalion's front. At dusk, a heavy firefight then broke out as the Japanese opened up with machine guns and mortars against Company G's area. During the exchange of fire, which lasted until 7:20 p.m., men in the pillboxes did not fire their machine guns since they did not want to reveal their positions. The firing died down to only a few exchanges during the night, generally directed at Japanese infiltrators, who were attempting to cut through the barbed wire. Finally, at dawn on the 12th, Magata then sent his 1st and 3rd Battalions in column to strike Company G. Although the attacking Japanese suffered very heavy casualties from machine gun fire, they did penetrate the first line of defense by sheer weight of numbers. Moving up the stream bed running into the sector, they captured one pillbox after another until they held a total of 7. Frederick then sent his reserve 1st Battalion to support Company G, while also launching a counterattack that managed to contain the enemy expansion. He also retook 2 pillboxes by the late afternoon. Meanwhile, Companies E and F of the 148th were converging against Iwasa's remaining strong points. Using grenades, rifles, and flamethrowers, they finally reduced the pillboxes one by one, leaving the Japanese in possession of only 1 pillbox by 1 p.m. As the historian of the 145th Regiment described in the fight for the last strong point, "On the second day, the last held enemy pillbox was subjected to everything an infantryman has at his command. Hand grenades by the dozen were thrown at the emplacement. Still, there was responding fire. Flamethrowers scorched the hidden nip into silence. The searching parties entered the charred remains of the emplacement only to hear the click of a Japanese grenade being detonated. In the far corner, they made out the dim outline of a Jap. Eyes bloodshot, mouth bleeding, face seared, clothing burned. His clenched fist held a grenade. Even as the men dove for cover outside the pillbox, the Jap threw the grenade at them as a dying gesture. Despite a heroic resistance, this was cleared in the afternoon at last, thus completely restoring the original 145th line. While all this was going on, after a heavy artillery bombardment, McCulloch then sent Companies B and F once again to storm the southern knob. Company B and a column of platoons with 6 flamethrowers attempted to storm the height from the northwest. The leading platoon was halted by machine gun fire from pillboxes dug in on the western slope. Once these were spotted, a concentration of mortar and machine gun fire was directed against these Japanese positions, enabling the following platoon to reach the top of the knob. There it was pinned down by heavy fire from machine guns sighted east of the observation post by Antrie. American mortar fire, together with the work of flamethrower operators, who were covered by barmen of the 3rd platoon, soon negated these positions. Although it appeared that the south knob would soon be in American hands, ammunition for the attacking platoons was running low. There had been numerous casualties. There were no more reserves. It was already late in the day. Despite all of this, Hodge then sent Company A of the 132nd Regiment to reinforce the gained position. Company A of the 132nd tried to scale the height from the southwest point to join Company B of the 182nd on the crest. A burst of machine gun fire killed the company commander, however, and this disorganized the attack so much that under the best conditions, the men could not reach the top before dark. Hodge then reluctantly recalled his forces, and sensing the futility of further attacks, he requested permission to pull off the southern knob. But Griswold refused the request, and a new attack was ordered for the very next day, using 2 companies of the 1st Battalion, 132nd Regiment. After another heavy artillery bombardment, Company A attacked southward along the narrow saddle, while Company B attacked up the southwest slope. Surprisingly, the 2 companies of the 182nd that had led the attack the day before had not been kept in immediate reserve, thus they had been pulled back within the perimeter. Therefore, there were no reserve troops available to help exploit the minor gains made during the afternoon. As the night fell, Major Raymond Dollar, the battalion commander, reluctantly pulled his men off the knob and he retreated to safer ground. Despite repeated attacks from the 12th to the 16th, Magata had made no headway and finally withdrew his forces. After Iwasa's retreat, the men of the 145th had the dubious honor of policing the slopes of Hill 700 and burying the corpses left behind. In an area roughly 50 yards square, corpses that could be identified were counted. This count included only those within the barbed wire lines in front of the pillboxes. As one observer noted, the carnage was a sight to turn even the most cast-iron stomachs. The enemy dead were strewn in piles of mutilated bodies, so badly dismembered in most cases that a physical count was impossible. Here and there was a leg or an arm, or a blown-off hand, all to show for the vanished and the vanquished enemy. At one point, Japanese bodies formed a human stairway over the barbed wire. 5 enemy were piled one on top of another, as each had successfully approached the location to use the predecessor as a barricade and then fell on top of him as he in turn was killed. Farther out from the perimeter, where a little stream wound its way parallel to it, Japs killed by the concussion of thousands of mortar shells lay with their heads, ostrich fashion, stuck under the least protection they could find. What was left of Iwasa's shattered command went to the relative safety of the Blue Ridge, approximately 2 miles east of the American perimeter. During the day as the Japanese were retreating, American planes dropped 123 tons of bombs on the intermediate area, and the destroyers offshore lobbed their 5-inch shells into the high ground to the north and east of the perimeter. Further east, Magata launched another night attack at 4 a.m., managing to gain another pillbox so Griswold would decide to reinforce Frederick with a tank platoon. Griswold agreed to send the 1st platoon of Company C, Tank Battalion, forward with the stipulation that they be used only to augment the infantry as he took back the lost pillboxes. 4 tanks supported a mid-morning assault which successfully retook 2 pillboxes. Another tank infantry attack began at 1:15 p.m., but it was halted since the tanks were low on fuel and ammunition. They were replaced by tanks of another platoon, which assisted the infantry of the 129th in destroying all the other pillboxes held by the Japanese and in restoring the front line roughly to the positions held before the Japanese attacks of the previous day. Alongside this, Grizzled ordered the Reconnaissance Troop 4 to occupy the right sector of the threatened area, with 131st Engineer Regiment taking over the extreme left. General Hodge requested to be reinforced with tanks, but as they could not cross Eagle Creek, McCulloch had him reluctantly decide to cease any further attempts to drive the Japanese off the southern knob. He thought that the three-day action against the Muda unit had obviously so weakened it that it no longer posed a danger to the perimeter. Thus, it could be contained and continually harassed by combat patrols and neutralization fire. On the 14th, the fighting fell into just intermittent small arms and mortar fire from the Japanese as Colonel Magata shifted some of his troops to more favorable positions, and as he brought his reserve 2nd Battalion, 45th Regiment, and 2nd Battalion, 13th Regiment, to reinforce further attacks. Magata also received the 1st Battalion, 81st Regiment, and the 3rd Battalion, 53rd Regiment from the north, tossing them into a new reserve. At 4 a.m. on the 15th, the Japanese launched a heavy local attack against the right of Company F. By dawn, they had captured one pillbox and penetrated approximately 100 yards into the perimeter, where they were ultimately checked. A coordinated counterattack by Companies F and C, in conjunction with a 36-plane strike against the Japanese positions, managed to retake the pillbox. Further tank infantry attacks finally drove the entrenched Japanese out of the salient and successfully restored the line. Losses for the day were 10 dead with 53 wounded, while 190 Japanese were counted amongst the dead. The Japanese then repeated the attack the next morning at 4 a.m. on the high ground east of Cox Creek, with a larger force of elements from 3 battalions. They penetrated approximately 75 yards before the momentum had been halted. Then Company B, supported by a platoon of tanks, counterattacked and restored the original line by mid-morning. Finally, shortly after noon, the tanks moved beyond the wire and shelled the draws and ravines in front of Company F until their ammunition was exhausted. Once again, the Japanese had paid heavily for no gain. 194 dead were counted and one prisoner was taken, while the Americans had lost just 2 men and 63 wounded. Though the counteroffensive is nowhere near done, that is all for this week, as we now have to jump over to the CBI Theater. General Merrill's marauders had been given the task of cutting the Japanese supply line over the Kemang Road. At Merrill's disposal were 3 battalions of Galahad, each in turn broken down into 2 combat teams. The teams bore the code names Red and White for the 1st Battalion, Blue and Green for the 2nd Battalion, and Khaki and Orange for the 3rd Battalion. Each team included a rifle company, heavy weapons platoon, pioneer and demolition platoon, reconnaissance platoon, and medical detachment, with a combined strength of 16 officers and 456 enlisted men. The marauders had been recruited from units in the Southwest Pacific and from Trinidad and the Caribbean. Many of the volunteers were notably seen as pure psychopaths. Their training in India was quite painful, a lot so for the military police nearby. 10% of the marauders went AWOL. Many of them amused themselves by shooting at cattle, chickens, and other birds, apparently even at the feet of locals to make them dance. One incident apparently had some of them aboard a train to Lido, firing out of the windows. They were seen as arrogant, psychopathic, gung-ho, and they had many colorful catchphrases such as, "My pack is on my back. My gun is oiled and loaded, and as I walk in the shadow of death, I fear no son of a bitch." Honestly, kind of a badass catchphrase. The baptism of the marauders did not impress their commander, who was obsessed with speed and efficiency. The Galahad unit had departed on February the 24th, and on receiving orders to move his forward assembly area, Merrill sent his 3 intelligence and reconnaissance INR platoons to check the trails as far as the Tawang Ka, the first of the 3 considerable streams that crossed the line of the march. At 6 a.m. on the 24th, the 5307th moved out, screened by the INR platoons. For the next 2 days, they clashed with some Japanese patrols, and at one point, one platoon led by Private Robert Landis of Youngstown, Ohio, was killed. Luckily, radio communication between the 2nd Battalion, 56th Regiment, and the 18th Divisional Headquarters broke down at this time, so General Tanaka was unaware that the semi-detached American unit was operating off his flank. General Stilwell fretted at the time it took them to cross the 130 miles over the Nagar Range to the battlefront. Part of the problem was that the 5,307th Composite was mule-based and had to bring over 700 animals with them, but none of them knew anything about muleteering. Whatever misgivings Stilwell had when he saw his reinforcements, he kept to himself and addressed them simply and quietly, explaining that their new mission was to hit Wallabum. On the afternoon of the 28th, Merrill received the new orders, calling for cutting the road on either side of Wallabum. The 2nd Battalion led by Colonel McGee to the west, and the 3rd Battalion led by Colonel Beach to the south, with the 1st Battalion led by Colonel Osborne to patrol along the Nabuhka, north of the Kemang Road. Positions near Wallabum would be held until the 38th Division relieved the 5,307th. Unfortunately, the freak rains already experienced by Stilwell and his men continued, so the Marauders' 8-day, 60-mile trek to Wallabum turned into something of a nightmare. On March the 2nd, the Marauders crossed the Tanaika and arrived at their assembly area. With the last elements at hand, General Stilwell initiated his offensive. On the 3rd, Colonel Brown's tankers, with the support of a battalion from the 65th Regiment, advanced against Mang Quan. Facing light opposition, they managed to advance 5,000 yards northeast of Mang Quan by 3 p.m., where they were halted by heavy Japanese fire. Meanwhile, Merrill's Marauders were clashing with Japanese at various places throughout the day. The 3rd Battalion had a sharp fight at Laganga, killing 30 Japanese and seizing the area needed for the buildup of a drop field. One of the battalion's two combat teams, Khaki, stayed at Laganga to build up and protect the dropping zone. Orange Combat Team kept on the high ground east of Wallabum and dug in, its heavy weapons commanding the Kemang Road. This saw them securing some high ground east of Wallabum. The 22nd Division was also moving on ahead, in step with the tanks of Galahad. On the 3rd, the 64th Regiment was near Nagamga, east of the Kemang Road. The 66th to the west was in contact with the 3rd Regiment, 65th, as it emerged from the Taro Plain. Tanaka's intelligence indicated that the Americans were at Wallabum. The Chinese 22nd and the 38th Divisions were advancing slowly, so he believed his rearguard could hold them back so he could take the bulk of his strength to attack the Americans. On the 3rd, the 55th and 56th Regiments began retreating in order to launch an enveloping maneuver against Merrill's Marauders. The next day, Brown found the enemy gone, and his men were able to advance 3 miles southeast, getting his tanks in line with Mang Quan. Over at Wallabum, Merrill's 3rd Battalion was resisting against ferocious attacks from the Japanese. The drop field at Laganga was attacked at dawn on the 4th, but the garrison managed to hold out. Orange Combat Team opened the battle in its sector with mortar fire at Wallabum, drawing mortar and 75mm gunfire. This was coming from the 56th Infantry Regiment, which had been Tanaka's left flank as it assembled for the attack. When it moved, the 56th tried to cross the river and work around the Americans' flanks, where they ran into booby traps and ambushes, thoughtfully prepared for just such a contingency. Some Japanese did cross to the east, but they failed to affect the course of the action, and 75 dead Japanese were counted, as against only one American's death and 7 wounded. These later were evacuated by air the same evening. The 2nd Battalion managed to get across the Kemang Road west of Wesuga, where they were establishing a roadblock. Finding out about the roadblock, Tanaka dispatched his forces to clear them out. On the 5th, the Japanese appeared to be forming up for an attack, but mortar fire seemed to be successful in breaking such attempts. To the south, Allied aircraft could be seen bombing and machine gunning what Orange Combat Team took to be Japanese reinforcements. One indication that the Japanese were increasing their strength in the immediate area lay in their being able to force Combat Orange Team's INR platoon back across the river at around noon. Simultaneously, the 66th Regiment liberated the abandoned Mang Quan and began advancing south over the Kemang Road. Brown's reconnaissance had found a good trail running south from Tsmat Ga, and on the morning of the 5th, the tanks moved out through the jungle. After the engineers had prepared a small stream for crossing, the tanks broke into a freshly evacuated Japanese bivouac area. Jungle vines looped across the trail from either side, and the connecting masses of vegetation and trees made effective obstacles as they slowed down the tanks by catching their turrets. Not until late afternoon did the armor break out of the trail running east and west between Mang Quan and Wusuga. Almost immediately, the tanks encountered what seemed to be a company of Japanese defending a small but marshy stream. The stream did not seem formidable, so Brown attacked by fire alone. Unknown to him, his tanks were firing on Tanaka's divisional headquarters, that now lay squarely between the 18th headquarters and the 56th regiment. This understandably threw Tanaka's plans into pure chaos, as his forces who were unsuccessfully attacking Merrill's Marauders were becoming encircled. Tanaka decided to swing his force around the American roadblock, using a Japanese-built trail that the Americans did not know about. The bypass road over which the 18th was to withdraw had been built by the Japanese engineers some days before, and quote, "The engineer regiment commander, Colonel Fukuyama, had considered the possibility of reversals in our position, and, in order to facilitate the withdrawal of the division, he had previously cleared a secret jungle trail, about 20 kilometers long, leading from the vicinity of Lalawanga to Jambu Hikuntang, on his own initiative. This trail was used in the withdrawal of the main body of his division." By nightfall, Merrill's 2nd Battalion had pulled out of Wasuga, and they were trying to link up with the 3rd Battalion south of Walambum. On the 6th, heavy artillery bombardments at 5:15 p.m., with an estimated 2 companies of Japanese in line of skirmishers with heavy supporting fire across the river. The American mortars continued their work. The automatic weapons held back the Japanese within 50 yards. 2 heavy machine guns, which had cleared a field of fire along the riverbank, were especially effective. The Japanese failed, leaving many dead on the open ground east of the river and on the river banks. Orange Combat Team found its ammunition running low, and so they sent a request to Khaki Combat Team for more, which was about 100 yards downstream. This was, however, just a diversionary attack, as most of the 18th Division was escaping unmolested. Meanwhile, elements of the 113th Regiment were beginning to arrive to Laganga, and unfortunately, an incident of friendly fire would occur. The remainder of the 38th Division and the American patrol met near Walambum on March the 7th. A recognition signal had been arranged. It was to be 3 bursts of 3 rounds each. This necessarily meant that there would be firing when the Chinese and Americans met. When the tops of the American helmets, which looked not so much unlike the Japanese pot helmet, with their brims being invisible, appeared through the overbrush, there was a brief exchange of fire in which 3 Chinese were wounded before identities were established. But such is the nature of coordinating multiple national armies during actions. General Sun and Merrill's Marauders made a withdrawal beginning on the 7th in order to circle south and cut off the Kemang Road yet again, this time even further south than before. Brown, in the meantime, had advanced to Ninkuga, where he was securing support from a battalion of the 64th Regiment, and he launched a coordinated tank infantry attack against Kumyen. At around 3 p.m., the tanks and infantry assembled across the Kemang Road in 2 places, establishing a roadblock while the tanks moved out aggressively along the road to the east and west. On the 8th, Brown's tanks then moved along the Kemang Road and onto a trail that showed signs of heavy traffic. This allowed them to discover Tanaka's evacuation route, finally occupying Walambum by the end of the day, where Brown would later recall, "Swarming with people from the 64th Infantry and the 113th Infantry, who, to the tankers' great disgust, disputed the latter's claim to have taken Walambum." Though the 18th Division had managed to escape Stilwell's traps, the American-Chinese forces had still scored a well-earned victory. The road to Mitkinya was now open. The cost for this first series of victories in the North Burma campaign were 802 Chinese dead, with 1,479 wounded, plus 530 undifferentiated casualties from the fall of 1943 to March the 18th of 1944. But the temporary American-Chinese collaboration did not presage a wider Sino-American synergy, and the Marauders found operating with their allies quite a problem. One major issue was that of disease. The Americans caught dysentery in large numbers, and they attributed this to the unsanitary habits of the Chinese, especially their refusal to boil their water or to wash their hands after using latrines. Likewise, the American K rations proved unsatisfactory and unsuitable for jungle warfare, as the Chindits soon discovered. Yet that is going to be all for Burma today, as we now have to jump over to New Guinea. The advance and pursuit upon Madang resumed on March the 12th, as the 2 and 12th Battalion found Ward's village unoccupied, while the 57th 60th Battalion secured the abandoned Sepi 2. The 57th 60th Battalion advanced swiftly by night and finally concentrated at Yokopi 2 days later. On the 16th, Brigadier Hammer then received a rather ambiguous order. Chilton had redefined the divisional's role in the light of the present situation. while the 18th Brigade was to watch the 15th Brigade's immediate left flank from the high ground between the lower Evapia and Mene rivers, the commando troop at Faita at the far left flank, and the 15th Brigade would garrison the Kankuro Saddle, keeping in contact with the enemy along the Bogajim Road and a patrol along the Cabinal River towards the Astrolabe Bay to join the Americans. Finally, the 15th Brigade would quote, "Provide a firm base for patrolling by employing at the discretion of the commander a force not exceeding one battalion forward of the Kankuro Saddle up to the inclusive of Yokopi." The order was ambiguous as far as the local commanders were concerned, and managed to overcome the ban placed by higher authority on any advance across the Finestres, over to the coast. Hammer could not go beyond Yokopi, but at the same time he was to maintain contact with the enemy along the Bogajim Road, and they were already farther back than Yokopi. Thus at this point, Hammer decided that the supply route from the saddle to the 57th 60th Battalion had to be developed. While the battalion patrolled and the enemy positions were bombarded, Saipa, Yokopi, and Domaya were built up into staging areas. In the meantime, patrols from the 2 and 2nd Commando Squadron were harrying the Japanese from their left flank, successfully establishing a new patrol base at Japa by March the 17th. From there, the commandos patrolled towards Aminik, Oromuj, and Mataloy, where they would finally find them all abandoned. Further east, the 58th 59th Battalion patrolled from the Nangapo and Yagalum areas towards the Arawum and Koltu, as they searched for the Americans at Kabino and the Kambara Rivers. An accident meeting had already taken place between the patrols of the two allies. An American reconnaissance patrol was being towed in a rubber boat by a PT boat with the object of landing at Male and seeing if any Japanese were at Bogajim. Off Garagasi Point, the tow rope broke and the Americans rowed to shore in the rubber boat, which they deflated and hid in the bush near Malamu. Moving further inland for about a mile, they turned west and neared Calico Track, where they met Lieutenant Norrie's patrol of the 58th 59th Battalion and accompanied the Australians to Barum, where the Americans were given supplies and a guide. Then they moved over via Wenga, where they reached Jam Jam on the 18th, and they found no signs of the enemy. On that same day at noon, about 30 Japanese with 3 machine guns and mortars attacked Norrie's position at Barum. The situation would have been much more serious had it not been for Sergeant Matheson and his 2 men who had remained behind at Calico, where they managed to bear the first brunt of the attack, and then they warned those at Barum. The Americans moved on the 20th to Yagalum, and the next day for Koltu, along almost exactly the same route as taken by Brewster, the one who had departed on the 20th. Brewster reached Koltu on March the 21st, where he joined the Americans from Sedor, and he remained with them until the 26th. In this period, he went to Sedor, where he met with General Gill, giving him information about the area east of the Cabinal River, and learning of the American intentions and dispositions. Brewster then returned to Yagalum, having carried out an important and lengthy linking-up patrol, over 35 miles each way. On the other side, General Adachi ordered his 51st Division to continue withdrawing towards Wewak, and for his 20th Division towards Hanza. There he sought for them to reorganize and receive around 5,000 replacements from Palau each. By the 9th, both divisions had reached Bogea, and the 20th Division had established a new defense at the Hanza area. By mid-March, the 51st reached Wewak, and they would assemble at Hanza later. On March the 20th, the bulk of the 41st Division was ordered to withdraw towards Hanza as well. As a result of the invasion of the Admiralty Islands, the 18th Army and the 4th Air Army were now cut off from Rabaul. Thus, they were reassigned to the 2nd Area Army under the command of General Anami Kurichika, with his HQ at Ambon. They would be responsible for the defense of the eastern part of the Dutch East Indies, the western portion of New Guinea. General Teramoto would also move his command from Wewak to Hollandia. Now back over at Yokopi, Hammer anticipated the constant patrolling and bombardment had forced the Japanese to withdraw from their positions. On March the 28th, patrols of the 57th 60th moved past Domonia and effectively found the enemy gone. The reality, however, was that General Nakai and Colonel Matsumoto had been ordered to pull back, to follow its parent units towards Hanza. The remainder of the 41st Division was following suit over the next few days. Only a 5,000-man detachment, deemed the Medang Detachment, formed around the 239th Regiment under the command of General Shogu, would be left behind to hold Medang and to cover the Japanese withdrawal. Emmer ordered the 5760th to move forward with speed towards Yala. Yet the Australians would be stopped at the Kafobi River on March the 30th. In response, a company would be sent in an enveloping maneuver across the river, successfully getting through the Mabilubu, although they would be unable to draw away the defenders. During the night, the surrounded company would then have to resist a number of enemy counterattacks, though these weren't really counterattacks, but the Japanese trying to retreat towards Madang. The following day, with the enemy gone, the Australian patrols would rapidly set north towards Yala. Meanwhile, the 2 and 2nd Squadron's patrols, after securing Mataloi 1, were advancing towards Yala with speed. And finally, the commandos would successfully enter Yala on April the 4th, with the 5760th Vanguard arriving soon after and then occupying Quedo by nightfall. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that, if you're still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, The Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Over there, I've just released a full documentary on the Battle of Attu, and it's getting quite popular, to be honest. Many of you watchers of the Pacific War Week by Week series over on KNG seem to really like this episode, and I did make it kind of specifically for you guys. And I'll state this, even if you do know the story of the Battle of Attu, I dramatized it quite thoroughly and I made sure to make it extra brutal and bloody, as it was quite a brutal battle. Also stating that, please check out my Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel, where I have more exclusive Patreon podcasts. Over there, I am releasing a 2-part series on the full history of the USS Enterprise, the Big E. That carrier had a service record unparalleled by any other warship in history, I'd say. It was a pretty cool episode to write, so please go check it out. The Bougainville counteroffensive proved that the Japanese could still unleash brutal offensives and meet some success. However, the level of success was not going to win the war, let alone the fight over Bougainville. Within Burma, the mixed national armies of the Allies were finding it difficult to work together, but little by little, they were pushing back the Japanese.